This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in, where we break up the hour into a few different topics. Coming up, we'll get an update on Pete Buttigieg's presidential campaign following this week's fiery debate with Adam Wren, who covers him for Politico. And later, why young girls need to see more women in STEM careers, some facts and figures on the disparity, and how some Indiana engineers are working to close the gap. But first, the Indiana General Assembly is in session, so let's start with a look at the week at the State House with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith. Hey, Brandon.
Always happy to be here.
And so let's start with Curtis Hill. We've been waiting to hear what potential consequences the Indiana Attorney General might face for groping allegations that came up in 2018. What did we find out late last week?
Yeah, it happened late on Friday last week. So for the purposes of, for instance, my show, it's this week.
Mm-hmm.
So the hearing officer in this case, so this is a disciplinary proceeding. And so the hearing officer says her recommendation was that Curtis Hill's law license should be suspended for 60 days without automatic reinstatement. And that second part is really important because we've talked to a bunch of lawyers about what that process reinstatement looks like. And the answer that one lawyer gave, for instance, Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, was at least 6 months. So when you're talking about a 60-day suspension, it could actually be 60 days plus 6 months at least.
Yikes.
To get his license back because of how that reinstatement process works. It's almost like going through the bar exam a second time. So that would potentially have significant consequences for his ability to continue being attorney general. Though what we learned this week from state legislative leaders is we don't really know exactly what it means about his future as AG. So the state law that lays out the qualifications to be attorney general only says you have to be a citizen and you have to be duly licensed to practice law in the state of Indiana. So if your license is suspended but not revoked, what does that mean? Are you still duly licensed? Are you not? And legislative leaders' answers were nobody knows.
Hmm.
What they're hoping for, what they're now publicly asking for, is for the Supreme Court to weigh in. So the Indiana Supreme Court will make the final decision in this disciplinary case. The hearing officer issued her recommendation. Both sides will file briefs and ask the court to weigh in and tell them what they want them to do. And then the Supreme Court, the five members, will come out with a final decision. What state lawmakers are asking for is, in that final decision, please tell us what this means. Like, if you suspend his license for any length of time, with or without automatic reinstatement, please tell us what that means for his ability to continue being attorney general.
So a temporary suspension for any other lawyer, like the guy across the street, that would mean that they can't practice law for 2 months.
Correct. At least.
And you have to be able to practice law to be the attorney general, but
this is
where it
seems
gets fuzzy.
It seems like it, but like somebody drew the example of the Clark County judges who were suspended without pay for 30 and 60 days over an incident at a White Castle here in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't stop being judges. Mm. They held their office. They just couldn't be judges for 30 or 60 days. They couldn't do their jobs for 30, 60 days, and then they went back to being judges in those offices as soon as those suspensions were up. Is the same true here? Nobody really knows.
Could the consequences change, though? So this was just the recommendation.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So this is a recommendation from – so we started with a recommendation from the disciplinary commission, which was like a 2-year suspension.
Uh-huh.
What the hearing officer said was 60 days without automatic reinstatement. It could be anything from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court could theoretically make it harsher. That seems very unlikely. My prediction this whole time has been something like a public reprimand at most, but it could legitimately be anything.
Okay. Well, do we know about when we'll find out?
We don't. The process for like the appeals to the Supreme Court now, generally like it's like 30 days plus 30 days plus 15 days max kind of thing. So even that process alone could be another couple of months. And then the Supreme Court, as far as I'm aware, doesn't have a timeline to make its decision.
Okay. Can you explain what this child internship apprenticeship bill is about?
Yeah. So when you apply for government benefits, food stamps, welfare,
mm-hmm.
Your eligibility for not only getting the benefits at all, but how much benefit to get is based on your income and assets.
Household income.
Household income. Right. And it's about $33,000, I think, for a family of four a year for – I'm going to get this wrong. I think it's one of food stamps or welfare, and I can't remember which. And then it's very small. It's like $8,700 a year for a family of four for the other one. And lawmakers didn't intend this, but what was happening was, let's say your child gets a paid internship or a work-based learning opportunity, an apprenticeship, where they are earning income. Under the law as it exists now, that income has to be counted towards that eligibility. Hmm. And lawmakers didn't intend that. That's just a flaw in the way the law was written.
Technicality.
Exactly. And so that was flagged by some folks who said, listen, you know, kids are turning down these opportunities because they're going to cost their families these benefits that they desperately need. And so what lawmakers, and this has been sailing through, I think, without any even no votes at this point, is just to say, okay, that income that the kid gets from an internship or a work-based learning opportunity or an apprenticeship, that doesn't count. The bill also was amended in the House earlier this session to say, not just for a kid, but if you are anyone in Indiana who is on welfare or food stamps and you get a temporary job working for the U.S. Census, which obviously is hiring right now because we are in the middle of a census.
And they need people.
And they desperately need people. If you go get a temporary job working for the census this year, we're not going to count that against you either.
Oh.
Because, again, we're just trying to knock down those impediments to things that we really need to have happen. On the one hand, it's kids getting these work-based learning opportunities. On the other hand, it's people working for the census on a temporary basis. So that was another step to say, we're not going to punish you for doing the right thing.
Getting a lot of support. Seems like it's going to go right.
Oh, yeah. It'll sail through.
Okay.
I believe it's up for passage in the House or in the Senate on Monday, and I think it would just go straight to the governor at that point.
We're one more step towards a hands-free driving law. What happened with that this week?
Yeah, it sailed through a Senate committee just like it had sailed through the House. I say that with some surprise because at the start of the session, there was a lot of skepticism as to whether or not Indiana lawmakers would go along with a hands-free driving law, but they clearly are. The only thing that I kind of caught my attention this week in the Senate committee was the support was overwhelming. It was like an hour and a half of testimony. Everybody testified in support, and the vote was 8-1 on the committee. But even some of those lawmakers who voted yes started to pump the brakes a little bit, pun intended, on the idea that this would be all that effective. Because as many people have pointed out, like, holding your cell phone in your hand while driving is not the only thing that distracts you. Yeah. Even using the screen, you know, the Bluetooth technology in your car can be distracting. Just talking on the phone while you are driving can be distracting. And that doesn't even get into all of the other things that drivers do while they're driving that are very, very distracting. And this bill doesn't address any of those. And so it wasn't like this is a bad idea. It was just we're not sure how much of a difference this bill is actually going to make. Now, what folks on the other side, maybe not the other side because they are supportive, but like, for instance, the governor, who's very, very supportive, this is his idea, this is his bill, has said he started to look at data from other states who have had these laws. And we have seen some impact. It's not a huge impact, but we've had seen in other states who have hands-free driving laws something like a 2% reduction in traffic fatalities after those laws were passed, which is not nothing. I mean, those are lives saved for sure.
Sure.
Again, I think it's not a question of if this will become law. It almost certainly will. It's a question of how effective it will be. And I think there's still some maybe disagreement about that.
Okay. Senate Democrats had some things to say this week about virtual schools. First, let's explain what got them talking in the first place.
Yeah, so two Indiana virtual schools are alleged to have defrauded the state by at least $68 million.
Wow.
And the ways they did this was artificially inflating their enrollment numbers. For example, if you were a kid who went to one of these websites and signed up to be interested in it, you were now counted as enrolled at that school. You had no idea that was the case. Mm. In some cases, they enrolled kids who had died.
Wow.
I have to say allegedly. So a new report that was just out recently in the last few days kind of outlined in a lot more detail about how some of this happened and the amounts of money, the $65 million or the $68 million and all that. And that sort of restarted the calls from Democrats to say, okay, here's these terrible things that happened. We have to provide more accountability and oversight in state law to make sure it doesn't happen again. Mm. And that's, you alluded to Senate Democrats. They offered some amendments in Senate committees to do just that. Things like requiring authorizers or these virtual charter schools in the future to put up a bond so that if there was malfeasance down the road, the state could recover some money. But in general, Republicans are just saying no to all of it. Their argument is that there's already enough oversight and accountability in state law. It just wasn't used properly by the local school that authorized the virtuals and the State Department of Education.
And we're planning a whole show on this on Monday. We're planning on having Senator Mark Stoops to come in and talk about that.
He will have plenty to say on it. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah. Be sure to tune in for that. That'll be Monday at this time. So the federal government raised the smoking age to 21 in December. Indiana's following suit with its own law. But more than 100 advocates showed up at the State House on Tuesday to say that's not enough. Who were they?
So it was primarily centered around kids. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because currently in state law, kids get fined if they're smoking underage. Now, underage right now means under the age of 18. This would now say under the age of 21 after the federal law and after Indiana follows suit to bring its own law into compliance. And what kids say is that's not really fair because you're not really punishing the people who sell us the cigarettes and the vaping products. But the bills that are moving through the General Assembly right now do that too. They are, and that was something, again, that the governor pushed for. He wants to punish retailers who sell to underage kids a lot more harshly than they have been in the past. There were companion bills, one in the House, one in the Senate. They did the same thing fundamentally. They differ on how much they punish retailers. One was really, really harsh. One was harsher, but not as much. What we're seeing right now is behind closed doors, lawmakers on both sides of the building are trying to figure out what's the right package. There's no question that retailers are going to be punished more harshly. It's a matter of degree in these bills. And we're probably going to find out this week what that final product looks like.
All right. In our last 30 seconds, the governor issued an executive order this week to address erosion along Lake Michigan. What's going on there?
Yeah. So this is a problem that's been ongoing for a while. And the governor's executive orders would kind of speed up approvals for projects that might help mitigate that, as well as explore whether he needs to declare an emergency so that we could get more federal dollars. Now, local communities have done that, but it really matters when the state does. Some of the frustration, though, with folks around Governor Holcomb here is that there was a study recommended by a bipartisan legislative committee over a year ago to do an Army Corps of Engineers study, and the funding was cut out of the final budget, and it's still just hanging out there.
Brandon Smith covers in the Indiana General Assembly for another few weeks. He's at the State House year-round, though. Brandon, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And coming up, writer Adam Wren covers Pete Buttigieg for Politico. We'll get an update on the campaign after the fiery debate in Vegas Wednesday night. I'm Matt Pelsa. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. We're back now with the Friday pitch-in. The first two contests in the Democratic Party are behind us. A primary, rather. And we're finally seeing where Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg stands outside of polls and punditry. And we're joined now by Adam Wren, contributing editor at Politico and Indianapolis Monthly, who's been covering the campaign. Adam, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
So let's catch up on what's happened so far numbers-wise. After Iowa and New Hampshire, where does Pete stand with delegates?
So Buttigieg at this point is the delegate leader. Now, both the Buttigieg campaign and the Sanders campaign have asked for a re-canvassing of specific parts of the Iowa results. But as far as we know, Buttigieg is the delegate leader. But going into the next two contests, that delegate lead is likely to erode in places like Nevada and South Carolina.
The Iowa caucus, though, is a logistical mess due in large part to the faulty reporting methods. But before the results were in, Buttigieg made what sounded like a victory speech to a lot of people. He said, quote, "We don't know all the results, but we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation because by all indications, we're going on to New Hampshire victorious." He caught a lot of flack for that. What'd you make of that speech and the reaction to it?
Well, I was in the room there at Drake University when he gave that speech. And when he said that Iowa had shocked the nation, there was some snickering in the press corps because in many ways he was right, but not for the reasons that he argued. Of course, the app imbroglio that happened in Iowa shocked the nation. But but for Buttigieg, that was an extremely cunning speech because it allowed him to claim victory and get many of the benefits of victory in terms of fundraising. He had his best hour of fundraising of the entire cycle in the day after that result happened. He also was able to blitz cable news shows and kind of talk up that victory. Still, we won't know. It'll sort of be one of the great political what-if questions of all time if there would have been a clean first-place result from him that night and he was able to deliver that speech in prime time. We'll never know how that would have changed the arc of his candidacy. It could have given him a momentum that he didn't quite achieve in the days after that result.
Well, some people, though, saw that early claim to victory and the media coverage as an advantage in the election. But you could definitely argue that his success in Iowa was overshadowed by that chaos. How do you think the campaign came out, I guess, after it was all over?
When all was said and done, I think they came out as clear winners, not only in terms of delegates, although the lead is pretty fractional at this point, but in terms of media buzz. Media buzz is the thing that has made Buttigieg's candidacy over the last 18 or 19 months really what it is. And he was able to leverage that. He was able to leverage that even the day before the Iowa caucuses when his campaign urged the Des Moines Register and CNN to spike a poll that had left his name off in the questioning survey process. That really focused 24 hours out all of the national coverage on the Buttigieg campaign in a way that it probably wouldn't have been had they not argued against the release of that poll. So this is a campaign that has mastered earned media throughout the process. And that could be a particular advantage over the coming weeks because Buttigieg really finds himself in a cash crunch right now. We learned just yesterday that he is asking his supporters to help him raise $13 million through Super Tuesday, which is about $1 million a day, every day from now until those electoral contests. He is not up on TV in any of the 14 Super Tuesday states that vote, and that is a critical disadvantage for him. And so he is in a moment right now where he is essentially trying to build an Indy car at the same time he's driving it at 220 miles around the track, so to speak.
Okay, so all eyes are on Iowa for months, and then if you win Iowa, that's a big momentum boost. But it sounds like he's needing some help to execute that same kind of strategy and keep up the momentum in other states then.
That's right. I mean, he got a huge momentum boost out of Iowa going into New Hampshire. I mean, his second place finish to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who is essentially a home state senator, was huge. However, the calendar moves so quickly that now we're on to the Nevada caucuses tomorrow and the South Carolina primary next Saturday, that he has to get the money together to really build a national organization in the Super Tuesday states. He's got about 25,000 volunteers on the ground, and he has employees in every congressional district of the 165 congressional districts that will vote on Super Tuesday. But still, he's facing another mayor, former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who is outspending him by hundreds of millions of dollars at this point. And so he also faces Sanders, who is a formidable grassroots fundraiser in his own right. And he is struggling on the cash front. He's been a great fundraiser. But from December to January, we saw his average contribution actually increase, which tells us that he's kind of losing some of his grassroots donors. And the larger donors are really kind of footing the bill for his campaign. He's done about 10 fundraisers over the last couple of weeks. And this is going to be a real test of his ability to put together an organization that is able to take him to the nomination.
Has anyone accused him, accused might be the right word, of putting too many eggs in the Iowa basket? Because it sounds like moving forward, it won't be as easy.
He had to do that. That was the bare minimum table stakes, winning the Iowa caucuses in order to really establish himself in the electoral process. Iowa was always key to his game. The real question is whether he's able to build a national organization. We know that on Super Tuesday, he's focusing on predominantly white Midwestern states who vote in places like Minnesota, for example, to win delegates. I've not heard anybody specifically accuse him of putting too much into Iowa, but he had to put every single dollar there to get a good result, to kind of build the momentum for this small town mayor, the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana, a statistic that now every national pundit knows. It's hard to say whether they know what the third or the fifth largest city in Indiana is at this point, but they could certainly identify the fourth largest city. So it's something he had to do. And now he really has to outperform expectations in Nevada, where there's a majority of Latino voters, and in South Carolina, where we see a number of black voters that he has historically struggled with over the last year to attract to his campaign.
There were reports that Buttigieg's campaign had given money to the company that built the vote reporting app. Some people raised eyebrows at this connection. What do we know about that?
This is sort of one of the great misinformation memes so far of the 2020 campaign. A number of campaigns gave money to this particular company, and there's been no demonstrated connection beyond that in a way that influenced the actual Iowa caucus process.
But let's see. Did we learn anything from? Let's move on to New Hampshire, I guess. Did we see those trends track in New Hampshire?
Yeah, Buttigieg has actually been able to build a significant base of support across a number of demographics. He's winning with women. He's winning with first-time voters. He's winning with college-educated whites. Really, sort of the missing piece of this puzzle is winning minority voters. When you look at Iowa, one of the interesting things is that he outperformed former Vice President Joe Biden in precincts that were the most diverse. And so if he's able to carry that sort of building block over into Super Tuesday states and win with Latinos in Nevada, I think that, we'll see kind of a formidable coalition develop. If he's not able to, we'll know here in the next 7 days whether his campaign is really viable nationally. I think he alluded to that himself in the debate earlier this week when he said that 2 weeks from now we could wake up to a Senator Bernie Sanders, who is the presumptive front runner in the Democratic race. And so really we'll find out here in the next week or two whether Buttigieg's candidacy is something that can go past Super Tuesday.
We're on the line on Skype with Adam Wren, who covers Pete Buttigieg's campaign for Politico. He was one of the top candidates in the New Hampshire primary, along with Amy Klobuchar and Bernie Sanders. Amy, like Buttigieg, is running as a moderate. Bernie is a lot more progressive. Buttigieg's campaign has two jobs, in a way, winning out as the favorable moderate and convincing voters not to vote for someone like Bernie, who he's referred to as revolutionary. What is his campaign's priority right now between those two things?
Well, his campaign issued a pretty stark memo yesterday, actually calling on Bloomberg to drop out of the race. Bloomberg has really kind of sucked up the moderate lane voters, a lot of the fundraising energy, a lot of the support from coastal elites. And he actually argued that, Bloomberg hasn't won a single delegate at this point, and that the longer Bloomberg stays in the race, the more likely it is that Buttigieg will have to exit the race, and that ultimately Sanders will win. Bloomberg, they said in this memo, had the worst presidential debate performance in history. which, you know, is up for debate. And so they really need Bloomberg to exit the race or to underperform in Super Tuesday states, or he faces a real existential threat from Bloomberg. He is someone who can argue that, yes, I'm a mayor too, but I was a mayor of a city, you know, much larger than South Bend, Indiana. And not only that, but I have championed some of the most important progressive causes over the last year, whether it was on gun reform issues with Everytown or whether it was on climate change issues. And he really, Bloomberg, really is responsible for the Democratic House takeover last year that we saw in 2018. And so it's a really fraught position that Buttigieg finds himself in to face another mayor who sort of parachuted into the race at the last minute.
The Nevada caucuses are tomorrow, and this will be the first majority-minority state to weigh in on these candidates. Buttigieg does not poll well among communities of color. What has he been doing to connect in Nevada?
Well, he's been meeting with sort of smaller, more quiet groups rather than these large town hall settings that he typically favors. And, you know, going to college campuses, meeting with, you know, law groups who are composed of primarily African Americans, and is really trying to make inroads there. One of the interesting things that we've seen from the Buttigieg campaign over the last week or two is that he has spent an inordinate amount of time in Nevada, where other campaigns are focusing on other states. The Biden campaign, for example, spending a lot of time in South Carolina. And Nevada is a very difficult state to poll, similar to Indiana. You've got sort of populations that, you know, come and go. And so we're really going into Nevada flying blind, so to speak. We don't really know what the polling is like there. And an average of polls, according to Real Clear Politics, he's sort of in the fifth position. But it's been, you know, kind of a week or two since there's been a poll. And so it's difficult to really speculate on how that voting group there might cast their ballots in caucus tomorrow. You know, of course, Sanders is the presumed front runner in that race and has really been doing a lot more than the Buttigieg campaign to reach out to Latino voters.
And speaking of support, a handful of elected officials here in Indiana have recently endorsed Buttigieg. Who came out in support, and does it matter?
Well, one of the biggest endorsers, not only nationwide, but here in Indiana, that we've seen over the last couple of weeks endorse him is Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett, who delivered Buttigieg's signatures to the Secretary of State a couple of weeks ago and endorsed him. And that was sort of an uncharacteristic move for a cautious Democratic politician like Hogsett to endorse so early. Before New Hampshire, even. But this, you know, this is really sort of a consequential endorsement, because right now the primary could head to Indiana and sort of cast the decisive vote, as we did on the Republican side in 2016 for our May 5th primary. And a mayor's support is significant, because a mayor like Joe Hogsett controls a lot of political machinery, and Buttigieg would need to do well not only in Marion County, but he would need to do well in the donut counties where a lot of suburban voters live. And they know those voters, even though they're outside of Indianapolis, they know who Joe Hogsett is. And Hogsett would presumably campaign for Buttigieg leading up to our May primary. So that could really prove a consequential endorsement.
So some significant support back home. But he's also gotten some pushback from local leaders in South Bend. After the New Hampshire debate, South Bend Councilman Henry Davis Jr. tweeted this. He said, "As a councilman in South Bend, I know why Pete Buttigieg looked like a deer in headlights last night when talking about systemic racism in the South Bend police. He tolerated it. He perpetuated it. And last night he lied to millions of Americans about it." End quote. His experience as mayor is a central part of his pitch to the nominee, to be the nominee. How much of an impact have these very local controversies had on his campaign?
They have been absolutely significant and central to his campaign. You know, one of his greatest strengths, the fact that he is a mayor who's outside of Washington, D.C., who has direct accountability on a lot of specific issues related to civic government, have also been his greatest weakness. June's officer-involved shooting really halted his momentum and continued the storyline that he struggles with issues related to minority constituents and minority voters. And so he has struggled with that and will continue to struggle with it. And in a way, it has put him in the spotlight with African-American voters that when you look at someone like Amy Klobuchar, who has a controversial record as a prosecutor, who has put, minorities in jail. He's sort of gotten a tougher look than she has over the last several months on issues that affect minority communities. And so, he's in the spotlight, and his calculation when he entered this race was that could be his greatest strength. But in a lot of ways, it's turned out to be his greatest weakness.
In our last 30 seconds, Super Tuesday is coming up. It'll be here before we know it, March 3rd, and the Democratic field is still really crowded. Is it becoming more clear how things might shake out, or is it still way too early to make any kind of prediction?
Well, we're clearly seeing that Buttigieg, Bloomberg, and Sanders are the most formidable competitors going into Super Tuesday. However, it seems to become muddier every day with Elizabeth Warren's dynamite performance at the debate this past week. She raised $5 million in the days after that. Buttigieg raised only $6 million in January alone. So there's more incentive for a larger number of candidates to stay in the race for a longer period of time, which really suggests that we're possibly headed to a contested adventure later this summer.
Adam Wrenn is contributing editor at Politico and Indianapolis Monthly. Thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
Up next, we'll close out the show with a conversation I had with two Indiana members of the Society of Women Engineers about getting more young girls interested in STEM. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. There's a lot of emphasis on STEM in education. That is science, technology, engineering, and math. But as far as representation goes, STEM careers are held mostly by men. Tomorrow, around 60 girls from grades K through 8 will show up at Ivy Tech in Bloomington for an event put on by the Society of Women Engineers. It's one of many events the group puts together to promote STEM education for women and girls. Here to chat with us are two of its organizers from the Society of Women Engineers, Katie Winner. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
And Nicole Elf. Thanks for taking the time.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
So, Nicole, I want to talk about the event. Of course, that's why we're here. But more important, I'm sure, is why you put on this and other events like it. Let's talk numbers. What's the proportion of women in STEM fields?
So women in STEM fields, when you look at it from a workforce standpoint, it's about 28%. And we only see women graduating with engineering bachelor degrees about 20% of the time. So when you look at it, we're over 50% of the population. We're really not represented well.
And I'm just going to play devil's advocate here because I have to. What some people might wonder, what's wrong with that? As long as somebody's doing the work, why does it matter whether more or fewer women are doing it?
So it comes down to engineers design almost everything that we interact with, to our chairs, to our cars, to the software that we work with. And if you think about, you want to have an application that applies to all the different demographics. And the best way to make sure you're represented is to have people that are on that engineering team that live that part of the demographic so they can give feedback. So you get better brainstorming on solutions when you have a diverse team. And we found there's actually studies on this that companies are more productive when they have a diverse team because a lot of people like to iterate off of each other. And so they bounce different ideas from their different upbringings and different perspective.
And different ideas come from different people, quite literally.
Yep.
Do you have examples of that maybe you've seen or have heard about?
So I've I thought one thing was interesting, especially when you think about females, is up until I think the last 30 or 40 years, brassieres were primarily designed by men. And so they obviously wouldn't know what a female is dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I think you've seen changes in brassiere design since women have gotten more involved. I've also heard about airbags that were not designed with females on the team, and they didn't take into consideration the different size of our stature. And there were some people that were injured as due to that.
Katie, as I was preparing for this interview, I wondered whether or not I knew any women engineers. Turns out I do, but I had to think about it. If the same question was, do I know any engineers? The answer is yes, and almost all the ones I could name off the top of my head are men. How much of a factor is that in how many women end up in engineering?
Sure. So I think that's a very good point, because we have studies that show that less than 50% of high school girls know a woman in a STEM career. And I think that really affects how many girls go into a STEM career in general. Exposing girls to female role models really helps counteract some negative stereotypes about women in STEM. So it's important to know people and for them to understand how each person can make an impact towards another girl or towards another person in engineering and STEM.
Well, so now you're an engineer. Did you have any of those role models coming up?
I did, yeah. So one of the reasons I'm even involved in SWE is I've been a member for about 10 years. I got involved in my collegiate section at the University of Dayton. And I actually got involved because of my dad's encouragement. And he's an engineer. And he was actually a SWE participant at his company when I was growing up. And I think it's really funny. He likes to take credit for me being an engineer because he's a very young father. So I was sitting on his lap while he was in taking college classes, taking DiffyQ. So he likes to say that, oh, I'm the reason why you're an engineer. You were just doing the math as a small child, which is not true, of course, but it's still funny. But I think he had a lot of effect on me as a role model, because some of the advice that he gave me when I was going into college was that some of the most influential leaders and women that he knew were part of these professional engineering societies like SWE. So that's one of the reasons why I joined. And I've always been really passionate about kind of the fairness and the way people are treated based on things that they really can't control, such as race, such as gender, that type of thing. So when I think about the impact that I can make as a SWE member and as a woman in a heavily male field, then I think that's what kind of drives me to be involved and to try to make a difference.
And remember, SWE is the Society of Women Engineers. And you said that your dad was part of it. And of course, your dad is male. Is it important to have male allies in support? Are there still?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think so. One of the things that I try to do as a leader of SWE and in our Indiana section is I try to involve as many male allies as possible. So one of the reasons why this is important to me is because I actually brought my boyfriend to a SWE conference, and that it's a conference that brings in thousands and thousands of women engineers. He's also an engineer. So when I brought him to this conference, I asked him what he thought after being exposed to maybe the opposite of what he's used to. And one of the things he brought up was that he's like, well, for a group of people that have experienced inequality and not feeling included, I really didn't feel very included in your conference. And that really hit me hard to think that now we've kind of created an opposite problem. So I think it's really important to address the fact that we may not make a change just a bunch of women sitting in a room by ourselves when we're the minority. So I think it's important to include male allies so that they can advocate and understand and that type of thing. So, and I think to your point, for role models, I just read an article recently about the impact of parents and role models on on girls and on boys growing up. And the study found that the person who stays home or who has stayed home the most or who's most influential in the kid's life, typically has been the mother, just from traditional roles, plays the biggest support and the most beneficial role for girls' achievement in STEM and choosing STEM careers. So I think that's a really important aspect to think about going forward, how we make an impact.
But at the same time, often the parent who stays at home is less educated. Has that come up as sort of a variable in that might be problematic?
It has in the past, but we're finding now that that's not as much the case. So recently, studies have shown that 56% of women get bachelor's degrees, showing that women since the 1990s have gotten much more educated. But I think to your point, something that I read recently as well is that even in millennial men, traditional views persist on who does what work at home. And I think that's still having a huge impact on women at work and even at home. And I think it holds women back more than maybe we have accounted for in the workplace. So
you're talking about the second shift, essentially. So a professional woman goes to work at a higher level job and then comes home and also has to do all of the housework and the cooking and the cleaning and all those traditional roles. And so men, younger men who might be, I don't know, to use a modern term, more woke, are still not doing those jobs that they need to do to sort of foster that kind of equality that you're fighting for.
Right, exactly. We're finding that an average woman will still spend about an hour to 2 hours more than men on housework and childcare, which is still, it's very impactful if you think about the amount of hours that every person has in a day.
So, Nicole, kids are naturally curious. They run experiments all the time, boys and girls. But it seems like there's a time in a girl's life when they're kind of steered away from that, or from STEM, I guess, to get specific about it, for one reason or another. About when is that?
So typically we see girls about 7 or 8 years old start to feel a little bit threatened by what we call the stereotype threat. So it's a fear of basically proving the stereotype right, that girls aren't good in math and science, or that getting dirty is something that a girl shouldn't do. So we start to see about middle school is when girls start to disengage from fear of proving the stereotype right, or they psych themselves out. And that's part of the reason why you see girls also start to maybe not stay engaged in some of the STEM activities or lean into those. We've also seen that if you were to ask girls about that same age range, if they were to draw what a scientist looks like, 85% of them will draw a male as the scientist. And that's just because they haven't been exposed to positive female role models that are scientists. And they redo that study and that number changes dramatically. And many of those girls that were then exposed to a female role model that had science background, they would then draw a female scientist once they're exposed. And that's part of the reason that SWE is so involved in these outreach activities, is to try to develop some of those role models so we can help break some of those stereotypes.
My wife is a scientist. She's smarter than me in just about every possible way. So I don't want to generalize here, but I'm just sort of devil's advocate. What do you think that girls steering away from STEM, do you think that's nature or nurture? To me, knowing the women that I know, it's got to be a societal thing.
I think it is a little bit societal, if I'm saying my own opinions. And there's actually been a lot of talk about this in the last couple of years about letting the girls tinker and letting them get dirty and work with their hands and use a hammer and use a screwdriver and feel comfortable experimenting. I know a lot of times I think boys and men have good intent that they want to help us, but they're like, oh, let me take that, or let your brother do that instead. And we just need to continue to nurture those girls. It's okay to get dirty, to work with a hammer, work with a screwdriver and build things. And that's the engineering process. Is you're not going to find the solution the first time you try to put it together. You have to iterate through that process and overcome the obstacles. That's part of the scientific process.
Are you also talking, though, about the and I don't know if this is nature or nurture, but the proclivity among women and girls to kind of be perfectionist?
Yes. And I'm not sure where that starts from. If it's probably a little bit of both, but there is studies that show girls want things to be done right, and they have a certain way that they want to do it, and they will almost obsess over something being done perfect. And that's something that they have to be taught to work through that. And what we say is have that growth mindset that it's not going to be perfect the first time you do something, and you might stumble and you might fail, but that's okay. And that has to be nurtured to start thinking about it in that growth mindset. And that starts from our teachers educating girls on that growth mindset, and our parents that trying to overcome maybe some of that nature that has been part of their, maybe it's nature and nurture, but has been instilled in them, is to be perfect, but breaking that and saying it's okay to fail and work through it.
Katie, let's jump to working age. Someone like you has been persistent enough to overcome these obstacles that we're talking about. Now you're an engineer. I imagine that you work with other engineers, many of whom are men. How much do things like implicit bias come into play?
Oh, a lot. I would say a lot more than people probably realize. Some of the challenges that I think people see as a woman engineer or a minority engineer, like we talked about before, a lack of role models, but it's also gender and racial biases and stereotypes that are experienced all over the workplace. I think that's a very deep-seated issue, that the only way to really overcome that is to explore your own biases, really understand where they're coming from and how they affect other people. Because that's really the reason why they're problematic, is when they affect other people and they bring other people down, especially if you don't know it. So the only way that you can really overcome that is by really digging deep into yourself and self-reflecting, being aware of how you affect another person and how other people affect you, and then really trying to overcome those biases.
So, Nicole, the event that you're putting on this weekend is a direct response to this disparity that we're talking about, not enough women in STEM. You're having around 60 girls ranging from grades K through 8. Again, those middle school years are crucial, and the late elementary years. What kinds of things will you be doing?
Yeah, so we're going to be doing some hands-on activities. We have 4 different engineering disciplines that they're going to work through, and we will break the girls up by ages so they'll get to play around and work through the scientific process, so make them a little bit more familiar with that. We're actually going to be bringing in some of our women that are still in college or have just recently graduated, so they can, we'll have a STEM panel, so all of our girls will be able to ask questions. It's great, some of the questions that we get from these girls. So, and then we're going to have an expo where we'll have different companies and organizations kind of showing what engineering can be in real life and answering questions from the girls. So it's all about letting them see women that are doing STEM and to let them identify as a positive role model. Explain to them what engineering is, because I know a lot of times I ask the question to a group of kids, and they think it's a train, someone that runs a train. I'm like, yes, that's one type of engineer, but there's a lot of others. Also, set them up with some organizations that, if they're really excited about this, that can continue to inspire and basically help them establish a community around them. In addition, we have a training session for our educators and our parents, so that way they know how to continue to support these girls that are interested, and hopefully keep them engaged in STEM throughout their high school and middle school years.
Okay, and registration for this event is actually closed, but I mean, could people get in if they really wanted to?
Not for this event, but there is another great event going on in Indianapolis on March 21st that I know their registration is still open.
Oh, okay. What's the age range for that? Same?
That one's actually K through 3. But it's the same type of event, hands-on, STEM outreach type thing.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both so much for your time, and I want to thank you for putting on the event that you're putting on. We're talking with representatives from the Society of Women Engineers. Katie Winner, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And Nicole Elf, thank you.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our shows are engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can get it wherever you get podcasts. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.